It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teaching, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. I want to welcome you to this new series entitled The 12 Nidanas, Buddha's Own Daily Meditation. Nidanas are the 12 links of dependent arising, which means the 12 behaviors, each dependent on the previous one, that linked together cause us the suffering of rebirth after rebirth, in which we experience sickness, old age, death, and the loss of everyone and everything that is important to us. This discovery of the Buddha was so important to him that he chose it as the subject of his daily meditation. There were only two choices. He gave all his monks two choices. You can meditate on the Four Noble Truths, or you can meditate on the 12 links. But he himself picked the 12 links. So the talk today, Buddha before he was the Buddha, part one, because next week we'll do part two. Much of what I say is comes from writing done by Taigen Dan Leighton in a book called Faces of Compassion. And his Zendo is in Chicago, and his teacher being Tenzin Roshi, whom everyone calls Reb, and the same as mine, I feel like he's a Dharma brother. So before Shakyamuni Buddha awakened under the Bodhi tree, he was a bodhisattva called Siddhartha. And those bodhisattvas who are particularly outstanding in, for example, the Buddha before he was the Buddha, Avalokiteshvara, who's the Buddha of compassion, and Manjushri, who is in every Zendo, is the bodhisattva of wisdom. And it's said that he sometimes, it is said that he embodies the wisdom of all of the Buddhas, just in Manjushri. But all of them are archetypes. That's the subject that I'd like to talk about. They're all archetypes, which means they share certain values and quality of being. And so I'd like to begin the discussion of the 12 Nidanas by introducing Buddha from the standpoint of these, of him as a bodhisattva and as one of embodying this archetype. Buddha, the word Buddha means awakened one. And so who he was before he was the Buddha will be the subject of this series. And so I want to give you a fuller picture of that. So first of all, what's a bodhisattva? Bodhisattvas are beings who are dedicated to the universal awakening or enlightenment of everyone. So they know, I mean, that it's an impossible venture that they dedicate their entire selves to accomplishing, whether or not, you know, and that's the spirit, whether or not we are doing everything we can every minute of the day to accomplish this inaccomplishable task. So the Buddha, or the awakened one, has fully realized liberation from the suffering of, you're going to hear this word a lot, so I'm going to say it, afflictive emotions and also psychological conditioning. Afflictive emotions means emotions like pride, jealousy, anger, hatred, self-pity, that are problematic to our spiritual development. And sort of in all these discourses on the 12 Nidanas, they're called afflictive emotions. But the Buddha has overcome all of them. A bodhisattva carrying out the work of Buddhas vows not to personally settle into the salvation of final Buddhahood until she or he can assist all beings throughout the vast reaches of time and space to fully realize this liberated experience. That's what a bodhisattva does. So if all beings have the capacity for clear, open, awakened awareness posited by the teaching of Buddha nature, then by seeing bodhisattvas as archetypes or patterns or approaches to awakening, we can learn models which we ourselves can each express for our own enlightening and beneficial nature. So I hope that's clear. By studying these bodhisattvas, and in particular the Buddha before he was the Buddha, and seeing him as an archetype and having patterns of behaviors, we can model ourselves on these patterns of behavior. And so that's the benefit of studying them. The inconceivable vow, a key aspect of bodhisattva practice, is the commitment or dedication to the way of awakening and to carrying out this commitment and practice for all beings. The aspiration to care for and to awaken all beings, called bodhicitta, we've talked about this before, is considered mysterious and auspicious. This heartfelt care for suffering beings and the fundamental questioning into the meaning of our lives, you know, what is this anyway? What are we doing? Arises unaccountably amid a multitude of psychological conditionings in our experience, known and unknown. But the initial aspiration of beginners seeking the way is said to be identical in nature and value to that of an advanced bodhisattva. So just get it. The moment you have this aspiration, this instinct, and we'll talk later, it doesn't always happen so like graphically. But that instinct is that bodhicitta, that moment of bodhicitta, is the same as the most advanced bodhicitta, the most advanced. All the bodhicittas that are primary archetypes are known as 10th stage or fully developed bodhisattvas. All the bodhisattvas that are primary archetypes. Practically speaking, they have the same understanding as a completely awakened Buddha, but they take on the job of helping all suffering beings also to actualize and make real this awareness. Although they may have realized the equivalent awareness of a Buddha, they return to the state of bodhisattva to perform beneficial works for beings. So that's what a bodhisattva is. And then a word about the Mahayana history. So the Mahayana Buddhist movement developed prominently beginning about what the one BCE, so one century before Christ. in northern India. But Mahayana Buddhism was certainly an organic development from early Buddhism dating back to this historical Buddha Shakyamuni, who lived in northern India in the 6th century BCE. So it gradually emerged organically, but it kind of really got its wheels rolling in one BCE. And then Shakyamuni as a bodhisattva the historical Buddha is not a cosmic archetypal Buddha like some of them are cosmic archetypal bodhisattvas. But our bodhisattva, Siddhartha, Shakyamuni before he was Shakyamuni. So Siddhartha, the bodhisattva, was a human being who had a life of profound impact in human history and originating a major world religion and mode of spiritual orientation that has inspired much of humanity throughout Asia and beyond. The name Shakyamuni means sage of the Sakyas, the tribe into which he was born in northern India. So Shakyamuni is just Sakya, which is sage of the Sakyas, which is a tribe in northern India. The major events of his life in the 6th century BCE are often referred to as characteristics of the lives of all Buddhas. So in a sense, the elements of Shakyamuni Buddha's life that are most prominent establish the basic archetype for all of bodhisattva practice also. We can identify 5 archetypal elements in the story of Siddhartha Gautama as bodhisattva. So the 5 archetypal elements are his choice between worldly and spiritual pursuits. Second, his awakening to the truth of suffering. Thirdly, his home leaving. Fourthly, his ascetic practice leading to the middle way. And fifth, his complete enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And I'll talk about the first 3 today and then the last 2 next week. So regarding his spiritual or worldly, and it was really Buddha or emperor, that was the choice. And so he was born as a prince, and seeing the infant when he was born, a wandering sage named Asita, known for his psychic abilities, predicted either this infant will either be a great worldly or a great spiritual sovereign. And these options actually pose the fundamental dilemma and choice for all humans in a way, regardless of innate talent or social endowment, whether to use our potential and capabilities to pursue worldly material values in purposes or spiritual ones. All Buddhist followers are conventionally addressed in the sutras as sons and daughters of good family, acknowledging the choice they have made and their innate nobility. Practitioners are often exhorted to abandon attachment to fame and gain, to persist in the choice they have made, to work for awakening. So we make this choice at some critical junctures in our lives, but we also face this choice again and again every day in the middle of our ordinary activities, in whatever life we're already leading, just as it is. We can choose to direct our energies toward accumulations of worldly power and material wealth, either well-meaning or self-serving, or else toward beneficial consideration of all concerned aimed at the development of spiritual awakening and liberation from suffering. So that's really interesting that it happens for all of us, really, these choices of kind of material versus spiritual in our daily lives and in junctures in our life across our lifetime. It also happens in politics a lot, and politics within companies and politics within spiritual groups. Yeah. There are those who are advocating for their own a little group that will forward them, or whatever that little part of the whole is, or others who are just looking at the whole and what's beneficial for all concerned. So the second archetype is the sheltering place and awakening to suffering. So in Gotama's, Siddhartha Gotama's Bodhisattva career, he was leading a comfortable and highly sheltered existence in the palace. And he was trained for his role of political leadership as a prince in the warrior class, mastering all of the martial arts, every single martial art of his period he was trained in and totally mastered. His father sought to protect him from any spiritual inclination and lavishly provided for all the material and sensual comforts Siddhartha might conceivably desire. We may recognize the protective impulse common to many well-meaning parents, actually. And since Siddhartha's father had been warned, you know, if you're not careful, he's going to turn into a spiritual giant, then so he was careful to just direct everything to him being emperor. The traditional stories indicate a great deal of innocence and naivete on the prince's part. So on a sequence of unsanctioned excursions outside the palace, he observed a sick person, and then on another trip outside the palace, he observed an old person, and finally a dead body. And these experiences awakened in him a deep, unquenchable concern for the problem of human suffering. This awakening to the reality of the suffering, like seeing a dead body and seeing an old person, and the desire for awakening, is known as bodhicitta. So this was his, on three different occasions, his Siddhartha's bodhicitta arose. This initial caring impulse is said to contain all of the qualities of awakening, although long years and maybe lifetimes of cultivation may be required for fulfillment. But on his fourth visit, unsanctioned, into the village, beyond the palace walls, let's say, he noticed a wandering mendicant, a typical figure in the Indian religion, and he was informed by his charioteer attendant of the possibility of a spiritual seeking as a life calling. So, oh, you can do this. So once informed of this alternative, Siddhartha's awakening heart and mind seemed driven to the conquest of suffering for the sake of all beings. The abundant pleasures and comforts that he had in the palace were meaningless in the light of the essential question of how beings could be liberated from life suffering. We cannot avoid old age, sickness, and death. So then the third archetype was home leaving. So the pivotal element in the story of Siddhartha as an archetypal bodhisattva is his great home leaving, abandoning family and position, fame and gain to seek spiritual truth. So the version that has been generally recounted in the West is that at 29, after these experiences into the world of seeing sickness, old age, and death, in the middle of the night, he left his beautiful young wife, Yasodhara, and child, Rahula, to begin the life of spiritual austerity in the Himalayan forests. So in some accounts, he's described as giving a last loving look back to his sleeping wife and child. This is the part of the story I love so much. After he became enlightened, everybody joined him. His wife and son, along with his stepmother, joined the Buddhist order, and his son, Rahula, became one of Sakyamuni's celebrated 10 foremost disciples. And his stepmother, Prajna Paramita, I can't pronounce her name, I have it written down, but I have a statue of her right by my desk. And she formed the order of nuns in Buddha's order. So she was the first nun in Buddha's order, the first woman. And that was his stepmother. Stepmother meaning that his real mother died close to childbirth. Like I think on the eighth day after childbirth, his real mother died, and his aunt took over. And so basically she was his mother his entire life. But we call her the stepmother. I've told you the story actually, that she walked barefoot in this ragged robe all the way to Buddha's monastery, along with maybe 50 other women, also barefoot, who, with the intention of not hearing any no's about, we want to enter your ashram right now, and we're not taking no for an answer, basically. And in the end, it was Ananda that forced the Buddha to say yes. And so they did. They were received. I've told you the story. This is when they were received, but there were like a million, many, I can't remember the number, many, many rules. Or maybe it was only 8, but they were really big ones. Like, okay, you can come in, but you have to follow the following, let's say, 8 rules. But they were heavy rules. But they didn't care because they were accepted, and that's all they cared about. So let's see. So I need to say this. Aside from the social implications, home leaving also denotes a deeper psychological meaning, abandoning the home of conditioned psychic patterns inherited through family dynamic and also from society. Those mental habits are the psychic karma we first derive from our parents, and later, to protect the self, we imagine ourselves separate from others. So to protect ourselves that we imagine is separate from others, we take on these psychic karmic habits. But such conditioning may be necessary to function in the conventional realm, but when we take on them as real and settle into them as a shelter, they become an obstacle to our awakening to our Buddha nature. So inspired by the dissatisfaction with the world and the wish to enlighten all beings, bodhisattvas must leave this protective, comfortable psychological palace and enter the unknown mental wilderness of awakening practice. Siddhartha's determination exemplifies this concern and the aspect of liberation that requires wrenching free from our unconscious deep conditioning. So we all have to do this. And it has an aspect of home leaving. Siddhartha's home leaving is especially controversial in the modern transition to Buddhism to the West, with its valorization of lay life, family practice, and the spiritual value of intimate relationships. The value of monastic or semi-monastic training and ordination has been accepted by Westerners, but even more than in China, we treasure the sutra of laymen Vimalakirti, layman. Many emergent Western Buddhist communities are dominated by sincere and often rigorous practice by lay people. Congruent with non-dualistic Mahayana teaching that this very world is the realm for realization, this is reflected in the emphasis on spiritual practice in family setting, with recognition that parenting and caring for personal intimate relationships may be challenging and even enlightening spiritual activities. So, and also the insights of feminism. There have been only occasional precedents in Asia for residential practice communities composed primarily of lay people, with men and women and families with children practicing together, such as a Green Gulch farm. Interestingly, early Sanskrit accounts of the Vinaya, that is the precept text, roughly contemporary or earlier than the Theravada sources, offer a story that's less worldly rejecting of this is the story of Siddhartha's actual last minute home leaving. And this text states that just before departure of the palace, Siddhartha made love to Yasodhara and conceived his son, contrary to the story of his merely looking back on them sleeping. And this version offers a rather different image of Siddhartha's home leaving, one in which he fulfills his husbandly obligations by producing a son and does not turn from sexuality in abhorrence. So there are different versions of this story. And so so this part is really touching. The Mahayana accounts indicate that Siddhartha's family received regular news of his activities and spiritual progress after his departure. I always think of him as leaving the home, and that's that. But this account, the Mahayana accounts say that no, there were five people who were his attendants, actually, or his charioteers that went out and kind of spied on him, and they relayed back reports of how he was doing, and eventually they joined Siddhartha in his ascetic practices. But based on the messages and on their messages and those of courtiers, the prince's wife Yasodhara simultaneously engaged in the meditative, ascetic, and dietary practices as Siddhartha did while she was in the palace. She simultaneously practiced everything that he was practicing in the forest as brought back by these reports. And one version of the story, I have to tell you this, one version of the story, and this is what Dan Layton says, with the full taste of Mahayana magical symbolism, records that Yasodhara remained pregnant with Rahula throughout Siddhartha's 6 years of ascetic practices, finally giving birth on the same night as her husband's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And so Dan Leighton says, while we may not care to take this literally, this account certainly acknowledges the great value of childbearing and birthing symbolically equated with Buddha's enlightenment itself. So there you go. It shows this Western, it actually shows this deeply Western value, actually, but this is how it's, this is one way of accounting or recounting this story of Siddhartha's home leaving. So although his home leaving is central in all the versions of the tale, the Mahayana attitude toward the family has a strikingly different flavor. And actually with his family having some role in his spiritual pursuit, and there's an implied promise by the prince to return and enlighten them as well, which is fulfilled when his wife and son join his order and his stepmother, here's the Mahaprajnapati Gotami, becomes leader of the order of the nuns. And many of his other relations also joined Siddhartha's community, his cousin Ananda, his half-brother Nanda. In the Mahayana, Siddhartha's enlightenment is thus seen as a family affair with blood ties acknowledged and loved ones included among the beings to be saved. Historically in Buddhism, the families of children who become monks or nuns are said to receive great merit upon their ordination. And so I've heard this for years, that if someone is ordained as a monk or a nun, the family, I think for 9 generations, receives merit for this. So finally, the different versions of his departure offer renewed attention to the inner meaning of home leaving, which may be understood in terms of shedding the antiquated home of family conditioning for the ultimate homecoming of the awakened heart. I think I'll stop there. And we'll finish this part of things next week. I'd like to review, just to make absolutely clear what is important to remember in this talk. And so, as I always do, I'm going to list 5 of the most important points before going on to giving you ideas for reflections for the week. But first of all, all the bodhisattvas that are primary archetypes are known as 10th stage or fully developed bodhisattvas. So all these bodhisattvas that I mentioned, the Buddha before he was the Buddha, Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva of compassion, Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, and there are various, many, many others. They're all 10th stage or fully developed bodhisattvas. So practically speaking, they have the same understanding as a completely awakened Buddha, but they take on the job of helping all suffering beings to actualize and make real this awareness. So although they may have realized the equivalent awareness of a Buddha, they return to the state of a bodhisattva to perform beneficial works for beings. So just to be clear, first you're just a beginning student, and then you have a moment of bodhicitta, like this moment of, oh, I could attain enlightenment myself. Maybe I will. And then there's finally embodying the bodhisattva vow, embodying that ideal. It's really taking the precepts and then living the precepts and getting your Buddhist name. I shake this because this is a miniature Buddhist robe that was received upon receiving the precepts from Shakyamuni Buddha, and getting my Buddhist name, and living a life of a bodhisattva, which I laugh because, you know, I don't think I've succeeded very well, but I think a lot of people feel that way. But it's kind of like, well, never mind. You know, I do the best I can, and that's just how it is. But I'm doing it anyway. I'm not saying I'm not doing it. I'm just saying I don't think I do it very well. So that's like, but I'm not a 10th stage bodhisattva. The Buddha, before he was a Buddha, was completely as if he were a Buddha. But bodhisattvas agree to take on the job of helping everybody else first before they fully settle into Buddhahood. So the second most important point from today's talk, I wanted you to get that point. And then the major events in Siddhartha's life in the 6th century BCE are often referred to as characteristic of the lives of all Buddhas. And in a sense, the elements of Shakyamuni Buddha's life that are most prominent established the basic archetype for all bodhisattva practice. And we can identify 5 archetypal elements in the story of Siddhartha Gautama: his choice between worldly and spiritual pursuits, his awakening to the truth of suffering, that we cannot escape those elements of suffering, birth, old age, sickness, death, and losing everything and everybody that's important to us. His home leaving, his ascetic practice leading to the middle way, and his complete enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Those are 5 archetypal elements in the story of all bodhisattvas, of all of the major bodhisattvas. So fourth, on his visit to the world beyond the palace, he noticed a wandering mendicant, a typical figure in Indian religion, and was informed by his charioteer attendant of the possibility of seeking spiritual life as a life calling. And this was like an aha moment for him. So once informed of this alternative, Siddhartha's awakening heart and mind was driven by the conquest of suffering for the sake of all beings. You know, I am going to find out the way out of this. I mean, this is like ridiculous that we all have to go through this again and again. What are we doing? So I'm going to find how to stop this. That was his job. He just took it on. And all the pleasures that he had in the palace were nothing compared to the question of how beings could be liberated from life suffering, because we can't avoid it. And follow the fifth, the last one, is that the fellowship of bodhisattvas working for universal awakening is seen as a wider, more fundamental family. Practitioners and devotees are encouraged. They even see each other. They see each other as Buddhas and more closely related to each other even than their genetic family. And then here are some ideas for your own reflection to bring all of this back home to you personally. I have 6 today, 6 ideas for you. The first one is related to that quote, the aspiration to care for and to awaken all beings, which is bodhicitta, is considered mysterious and auspicious. This heartfelt care for suffering beings and fundamental questioning into the meaning of our lives, what are we doing? What are we here for? Arises unaccountably amid a multitude of psychological conditionings in our experience, known and unknown. So this is very mysterious and auspicious. So please take a note to look over your own life. Since you are here listening to these talks, you too must at some point have experienced this mysterious and auspicious calling. When did this happen to you? What were the specifics of your circumstances? How have they expressed themselves in your life? And I say this, it doesn't happen like, oh, that just happened. It's kind of, it is mysterious. But you wouldn't be here if it didn't happen on some level. So at some point, you just had a kind of a opening, really opening to helping beings in some way. And that's what we're talking about. And so how did that happen for you to be more conscious of it? That's the first reflection question. And secondly, these options actually pose fundamental dilemma and choice for all humans, regardless of innate talent and social endowment, whether to use our potential and capacities to pursue worldly, material values, or spiritual ones. So I want to ask you to describe how this dilemma, this worldly versus spiritual, how this played out for you in your lifetime. So actually, question two and three are, they're almost the same, only on different levels. Question two is, how did this play out in junctures of your life? Like, oh, when I was in high school, I decided such and such, and then I did such and such. And then when I got employed, you know, I had this decision, or when I decided to get married, or things like that. Those kind of choices, it junctures in your life. And the third question is, those kind of choices minute to minute in your life, like really, how I'm gonna clean this sink absolutely to the drain. I'm gonna clean the drain, and I'm gonna clean, you know, just all the walls perfectly. As you know, as you really get into the details, that's showing consciousness of the universal at the same time. So your ability to get into the details reflects your ability to get into the universal. And so I'm asking you to reflect on both how this works in your life's junctures and how it works day to day, minute to minute. And then this idea of home leaving reflecting deeper psychological meaning, that you're leaving the habits and the kind of ideas of your family and your society and yourself as you imagined yourself when you take on this kind of spiritual practice. And so what are those things? What were some of the habits and trainings of your family and social environment that you're leaving? What psychic karma have you inherited either from your family or society that you would consider obstacles to spiritual development? That's the fourth question. And the fifth one, I'm going to read something to you, and I'd just like you to comment on it for your fifth reflection. Many emergent Western Buddhist communities are dominated by sincere and often rigorous practice by lay people, congruent with non-dualistic Mahayana teaching that this very world is the realm for realization. This is reflected in an emphasis on spiritual practice in the family setting with recognition that parenting and care for personal intimate relationships may be challenging and even enlightening spiritual activities. Please comment on that. Just think about that very carefully. And how do you feel about that? You know, to your heart's content, please comment on that. It's a very important question. And lastly, the different versions of Siddhartha's departure offer renewed attention to the inner meaning behind home leaving, which may be understood in terms of shedding these antiquated family conditioning for the ultimate homecoming of the awakened heart. And so I'd like you to comment on this attitude of the ultimate homecoming to the awakened heart, as opposed to the home leaving of our family of origin. It's really asking for the homecoming to our dedication to help all beings versus what we were brought up thinking we were doing in this lifetime, either socially or family-wise. So it's a big difference. So just think about that. These reflection questions will be posted, so you don't need to take any notes and you don't need to remember them. In the name of time, I think I would like to ask if there are any questions.
Yes, Gail. The first one that we have is, I'm not sure if this is a question, but I was particularly moved by the part of Siddhartha's story where he saw the wandering mendicant and realized that spiritual seeking could be a life calling. Like, oh, I can do this. It seemed so tender and so simple. I've had moments like that of realizing that something completely obvious might be related to me. And it was such a life changer. How blessed must be that particular wandering mendicant? I mean, it was because of him, one might say.
I know, because of this wandering mendicant, we're sitting here studying Buddhism. There wouldn't even be Buddhism. Well, I feel called to share with you something that happened to me not yesterday, but the weekend, last weekend. I went to Green Gulch for the weekend in order to see, I thought, how cold the Zendo actually is and whether I could follow a schedule unlike my normal daily life schedule in these cold conditions. That's what I thought I was doing. So I went from Saturday evening to Monday morning. I just wanted to test out experiencing evening zazen Saturday night and then morning zazen Sunday morning, getting less sleep than usual, and then same Sunday night and Monday morning. And then that would be enough for my experiment, I thought. That's what I thought I was doing. So I go there, you know, pack up all my stuff, and get there. And the first thing I learn is, oh, we're in interim. There is no Saturday night or Sunday night zazen. So, oh, okay. There goes that experiment. And then, but I go to Sunday morning zazen and have a day there, et cetera. And then I go to Monday morning zazen, and I faint in the zendo. I actually fainted in the zendo. And so then somehow I got out of the zendo, and then I went into Reb's room, where I was supposed to have Doksan anyway. But I just went in, no bowing or anything like that. And I felt like I was okay by then. But Reb said, can I walk you back to your room? I said, no, I'm fine. You know, you don't have to bother doing that. No. And then there was some moments like that. And then finally he said, may I walk you back to your room? And then he did walk me back to my room, which was a good thing because there was lots of stones on the path and it's just like a dirt path. And I wasn't really very strong after all. So then, and then actually Green Gulch arranged a driver to drive me home in my car with a car following to drive her home in their car. They went to all that trouble for me. And then the next day I was meditating and it just came to me in like this, the same, I know what this weekend was about. This weekend was about Reb walking me back to my cabin, doing the kindest thing. Reb did the kindest thing that he could do in that moment. Do I do the kindest thing? You know, I don't, sometimes I don't even think about it. And so I realized, I thought I was going for this like convoluted idea. And what I got was this incredible lesson in my body of the kindest thing. And now I'm actually thinking about it. You know, I really am. Situation, I just think, well, what would be the kindest thing here? It's way more in my mind now. And that, but I'm just saying that these experiences are like, oh, like with Siddhartha, like, oh, I could take spiritual calling as how to organize my whole life around that. That's so obvious. And like, this is so obvious to do the kindest thing. It's so obvious. I'm like, oh, that's about me doing the kindest thing, you know, at me. I, with my body, it's about me doing the kindest thing. And that's what I learned for a weekend at Green Gulch. But it was this, oh, and it's so obvious right in my face, but I had to be hit over the head, literally hit over the head. I had to fall and bump my head and then get it. And maybe it won't be so difficult for you, but I think all of us have these oh experiences, and that's kind of what I'm relating to. And they're so powerful. They're just so powerful. And now I think we're almost out of time. Is there a short question?
Yeah. So there's another one. The question is, did the Buddha's father ever become a practicing Buddhist?
So the king, Buddha's father, what I can tell you about him is that he came, first of all, whenever the Buddha was traveling, see, after he was enlightened, the Buddha taught, I think he was never alone for one day after that, and he taught for, I think, 40 years. It couldn't have been that long. He taught for every year after that. He died when he was 80. And I can't remember, did I say how old? Well, he was 29 when he left, and he practiced 6 years, so that would be 25. So 25 to 80, 35, 45, 50. So maybe, anyway, you can do the math. That's how many years he walked from practice place to practice place. And many, many kings said, I'm going to build you a place to be because I want you to be here and teach me, and then teach, and then the whole community. So many, many wealthy beings built like monasteries for the Buddha to live in temporarily while he was passing through town. And his father built one of those. His father built a very large monastery or practice place for his, you know, when Buddha traveled, he could have as many as 500 monks traveling with him. And they all on foot, and then they all had a place to be, like in the forest usually. And wealthy people provided these practice grounds. And that's what the father did. So I don't know what, if the father actually practiced what he learned from the Buddha when the Buddha came to teach, but he certainly was open to the Buddha's teaching. He invited the Buddha to teach him and all of his staff and everybody in the palace. And he might have even visited the Buddha in other places, in other of the practice grounds. They were all gorgeous, some more gorgeous than others, but all gorgeous. And they were just offerings of so many people who wanted to learn what the Buddha had to teach, because the Buddha was radiant and everyone could just look at him and see the light just coming out of him. And so it was really clear that he had something different. Now I see I absolutely have to stop, and I want to thank everybody, all of you, for coming, and my staff, Brendan and Sahar and Brian, all the work they do, without whom this could not happen. And I'm so grateful, and I hope to see you next week and for, 8 weeks after that, when we really get into the 12 links. Bye-bye for today.